Hi there, folks, and welcome or welcome back to Nippon Trading International's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima again, and this podcast is brought to you, among others, by Emil Gorgis of realestate.jp. He's a Tokyo real estate agent who specializes in serving international or mixed nationality families who are looking for the perfect family home. So Emil's an Australian. He's been living here in Japan for over two decades now. And for about half of that time, he's been buying, selling, and managing real estate properties in Tokyo on behalf of his own family and a great many happy clients. And he also acts as a mortgage broker on behalf of his clients. So he's got dedicated loan officers in many of the Japanese mega banks. And if you're a regular listener of the podcast, you probably already know him from our JREP, the Japan Real Estate Experts panel sessions, which means that you're already aware of the fact that the man is an absolute fountain of wisdom on all things related to real estate in Japan, and in particular to family homes, the greater Tokyo metropolitan area, and mortgages. And most importantly, he's incredibly generous with his time and advice, which he's more than happy to provide at no cost or commitment to anyone asking. So if you've been thinking about buying your home in Tokyo, but you've been sitting on the fence for a while, or you just want to have a chat in English with a real expert, drop him a line on sales@realestate.jp. Hit him up today and start exploring your options.
All right. As always, before we get started, quick reminder, just in case you've been living under a rock, that the spring session of the Japan Real Estate Summit is taking place in about a week and a half in Akihabara, Tokyo. That's Saturday, April 6th. Tickets have been selling fast, as is normally the case. We're now at about half of the venue's capacity for in-person attendance and about a third of the Zoom room's capacity for the live stream. And of course, selling more by the day. So if you haven't yet secured your in-person or live streaming tickets, and you do want to make sure you don't miss out on the best industry event in Japan, which will give you the opportunity to network with dozens of like-minded property enthusiasts, listen to and pick the brains of our experts panel, including Tracy Northcott, Blanca Kobayashi, Anton Warman, Emil Gorgis, Joey Stockermans, and Daigo Sato-san, our two new guest speakers just announced, and of course yours truly, hop over to nippontradings.com. That's N-I-P-P-O-N, Nippon Tradings with an S, all one word. Click on the Japan Real Estate Summit link at the top and come join us for an awesome day, live or online. Now, for today's episode, again, two back-to-back conversations. You'll notice I'm doing a lot of this recently, mainly because the backlog of content that we need to publish is getting a bit ridiculous. You'll notice that I'm spooking last October's summit at the end of this first conversation, which should give you an idea of how behind we are. And those are both on the topic of investment properties today. So this first video conversation is with a young but quite experienced investor from the US who's about to invest overseas for the first time. We analyze his existing investment portfolio in the US, try to see how it's structured and how we could complement it with his first few Japanese investments for diversity purposes. So we talk cash flow versus potential growth potential, short-term versus long-term residential properties, and how much work is involved in both, the availability of financing for non-resident investors like himself, both from domestic and foreign lenders, and what he would be able to buy with either his cash or alternatively his leveraged purchase budget projections. Also a bit about loan terms, interest rates, and then about how our services work, what we do for our investor clients, how management works, cost of maintenance, renovations, repairs, which also led us naturally to talk about condo units versus mansions, condo units or mansions, houses versus entire building purchases, advantages, disadvantages of each of those property types and what they're best suited for. A little bit about tenants, how to vet them, how rental prices are determined, locations around the country and specifically around Tokyo, which he's more familiar with, why yields are so low and how long that might last, and much, much more. So enjoy the conversation and I'll see you again on the other side.
Awesome. So let me just scroll down through your email because I've got no memory to speak of. Give me a second. Okay. Nearing the completion of one of your properties, planning on selling it off to the right buyer, and then you would like to use the profit to possibly invest into Japan. Okay. Different real estate business models. Okay. So when you say business models, what did you have in mind?
Yeah, so first off, thank you for meeting me. I appreciate it. So when I said business models, I guess what I really meant is like in terms of like appreciation versus like cash flow. Because I know some investors buy for more so appreciation, some are more geared towards cash flow. And from what I've heard from your podcast, not so much appreciation, I think, in Japan. Is that correct?
Well, I mean, with a caveat, the last 15 years or so have been pretty good in major metropolitan centers. So let's say Tokyo, Osaka, Fukuoka, Central Yokohama, Kobe City have all gained in value. Kyoto gains kind of steadily over time, a bit slower, but definitely gains in value as well. But that's on the back of 25 years of deflation and a shrinking workforce, which are very quite serious tailwinds. So not having a crystal ball, I would say we advise most of our clients at least not to bank on that as a strategy. Definitely make sure the cash flow is there. But if you'd like to also purchase, if you can live with slightly lower yields and you can purchase in one of those that tend to do very well when the economy does well, then that's definitely a hybrid strategy that you could pursue. But I guess the main question is, what does the rest of your investment portfolio look like otherwise? Let's say in other countries, other asset classes.
So right now, the three properties that I sent you are all in the United States, are all in Texas. So this would be my first time investing internationally. I've been to Tokyo once, and that was this year in March, but I was only there for like 9 or 10 days. So this would be my first time investing internationally.
Okay, and the properties that you have, are they cash flow oriented, growth oriented? What are they like?
Both. So I got really lucky. So in the United States, the market was doing really well in like around 2020, 2021. The interest rates were historically low, I think at like around like 2%.
Yep.
So I took advantage of that. At the time, I didn't really have that much money. But I bought in and I took a risk. And one of the properties I bought it for 219. And since then it's appreciated to 305, and it's only been maybe 2, 3 years, something like that. I don't expect that again by
Yeah.
any means. That was, I know, obviously, I know that was very, very lucky. So I guess in terms of that, that property, it's in revenue, it's doing about like right at under 20K. In terms of cash flow, I would say it's probably cash flowing about maybe like 9 or 10% of that.
You bought it in cash, did you?
A good amount. So I bought it with a VA loan. So I guess in the United States, there's certain different kinds of loans, right? Like conventional loans, or like they offer VA loans too, which are for veterans
Yep.
of the United States military, which gives us really good deals. So it helps us like go and buy into the market.
So the 9-10% that you're saying, is that cash on cash for what you're paying monthly, or is that compared to the actual price of the property?
Yeah, it's cash on cash.
Cash on cash. Okay, so probably more like 5-5% if we were to compare it to the actual value versus yield, right?
Yes,
Yeah.
that's correct.
So are all three of them like that, similar?
No, so that's the one that I bought in 2021, I believe. The land that I'm working on right now, that one is going to be, I guess, what they call it in Tokyo, like a minpaku. I
Yep.
don't know if that's the right term,
Airbnb
but that,
kind of, yep.
yeah, that's what I have it out as. It's in the hill country in Texas, and there's not very many restrictions there,
Yep.
so not really any HOAs or like deed restrictions.
Yep.
So that was kind of my plan, but I had somebody approach me, saying that they might be interested in. That's a cash buyer, and that's what I'm trying to finish right now is completing it. So I bought the land raw. It only had a water meter in it. And then I added a septic tank and I added an electrical infrastructure, and then I
Yep.
put a tiny house on top of it. So it has all that stuff on it now. So I'm
Okay.
trying to get money for it.
And how are you enjoying slash capable of managing the fact that it's short-term stays? Because that consumes a lot more bandwidth, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. It's like I feel like a lot of people think it's like super passive,
No,
right? Like,
it's not.
it doesn't work that way at all.
No.
Like I've had Man, I've had people ask me for like the weirdest things, like which probably some of the things I shouldn't even mention on here, but like people can be very needy, even if you try to like plan stuff out ahead, like and have like all the amenities and everything set up, things can still go wrong. I had an instance where the power shut out, and we had to drive like 45 minutes to get a new breaker
Oh, you're
and go to
managing
that.
them yourself, hands on?
Yeah, I'm managing it myself. Yeah.
Wow, okay.
I haven't had a property manager other than for the single family home that I have. But that's because the guy that's the property manager is also my friend, and he's also a licensed real estate agent. And him and I had a deal that if he managed the property for me, that I would keep buying real estate from him.
That's
So
awesome.
that's kind of what we worked out.
Okay, so that's the second
That's
one. You mentioned three, right? What's
Yeah.
the
So
third?
the third one is the one I actually live in.
Okay,
So
gotcha.
that one I bought for 325. And that one's appreciated like maybe like 20K since then. So that one's not too bad, but really I got lucky with that first one, and that's kind of where I'm at right now.
Okay, gotcha.
I want to get rid of that lake property that I have, because it's pretty sought after. As far as like the area, people, for whatever reason, people are going out in the middle of nowhere, I guess, getting away from everything and just being out, like out in the country. It's also like, it's probably like 0.2 kilometers from like a really big lake.
Okay.
Right now the lake is dried up, so that's why I got it for such a good price. But typically it'll come back.
Okay, so let's call it two investments. I'll put the house that you're living in aside for a moment. Hopefully it'll gain in value, but we don't know. So you've got one that you'll be liquidating that's been generally high yield, but kind of a bit of a headache, and one that's generating kind of safe and stable returns on, I'd say, again, I'm not taking the loan into account, but let's say 4 or 5%. So kind of stable, relatively hassle-free, I'm assuming. I mean, I know that US tenants are not as easy as Japanese tenants, but you haven't had too many issues from the sounds of it, right?
Yeah, and my property manager takes care of everything for me. So I've never even met the tenants that are in that house. He
Okay.
does everything, the credit checks, if there's any kind of attorney's fees or they do something crazy, he handles all of that.
Okay. Well, assuming that this is your first investment overseas, definitely in Japan, but also overseas, and what kind of budget were you thinking about to invest overseas?
So from listening to your show, I've heard it's pretty much near impossible for foreigners to get any kind of like loans or any kind of like mortgage.
There are a couple of options, but those require either setting up a company in Japan, which comes with like $3,000 or $4,000 a year and just corporate upkeep costs. So that's probably only valid if you're going to be investing in, let's say, $500,000 and over. Otherwise, it's kind of eating into your income. The other option is there's a Singapore lender that will lend, but only for condo units. So you're not going to have any, I mean, you're going to have a bit of the land, which is shared between the owners, but you're not actually going to be able to benefit from any growth, or at least not as much as a fully landed property.
Right.
And the first one charges something like 2.5% interest, the second one, something like 3.5%.
That's so low.
Yeah, it is. But
The
it's
US is like 8% right now.
really wow.
Yeah, it's insane here.
Okay. And so I mean there are options, but each of them would also have a minimum required asset price. So what kind of cash outlay do you have? Let's say you take a loan, how much cash can you put into it?
So without selling the lake property, I have around 50K in cash. If I can sell a lake property, which I want to do, like more now, like sooner than later, I know that I can get like easily 100K for it, like cash back from it, because I have a lot of cash that I put into the deal, into the Lakeland, so I know I'll get it back. It's not levered very much. Like there's maybe like probably like maybe 40,000 of a loan on that entire thing, and it's worth probably around like 220. And I think I can maybe sell it for like very, very, very like minimum, like maybe 160, 170.
So then you'll have a total of 100 or 100 or 150, including what you
I think between then, yeah, between then, yeah,
have.
between 100 and 150, and then plus the 50K cash. So I
Okay.
would call it conservatively maybe 150.
Okay, so I think from memory, both lenders would require asset price of 10 million yen, which at the moment is something like 80,000 US, I think, or 70, 80,000 US.
That really it? That's all they need?
I think so. Let me
Not
check.
bad at all.
Let me just confirm. What's that? 10 million Japanese yen in
That's the other
US.
reason why I want to invest, because I love the exchange rates there.
Yeah, not a bad. Oh, even less, 66,000 at the moment, 67,000. Yeah. So I guess those are options to you. But if we're going with the one that requires you set up a company, then you're talking about, let's see
That's
how
okay.
much. Yeah. So, like, if the corporate upkeep is going to be like, let's say, worst case scenario, $4,000 a year, I guess you don't want to pay more than 5-10% of your income. Just for
Okay.
that, right? That's a bit of
Can
a
I
risk.
ask how difficult is it? I mean, we don't have to get too like into it, but is it pretty easy to say I open a KK there and I have like a lawyer and a CPA and I can pay them to take care of most of the things for me? Is it pretty easy, or would I have to get pretty
You'd probably need a GK, not a KK, but yeah, I mean,
I'm
it's
looking
a
at
process.
options.
It's a process. They can do it for you. It's a process. We just have the first customer. Most of our customers were not interested in these loans, but we have one who's finalizing one of them now. There's a bit of a debate now on whether, because they required a Japanese resident as director of the company. And we can provide that service, but what we don't want to do is to be in any way obligated or
Like
be on the
legally
spot for
liable.
any legal or financial. Yeah. So
Understandable.
if you get in touch with me again in a month, I'll let you know if we were able to sort that one out or not.
Okay. I guess as a contingency, I have a friend that's a Japanese resident in Tokyo.
Resident as in permanent resident?
Yeah, he's Japanese nationality. Like he's
Oh,
from
Japanese
Tokyo.
national. Okay.
Or actually Fukuoka, but I think he lives in Tokyo.
Would he be okay though with having that obligation?
I can't speak for him,
Yeah.
but that's something that I could ask him. Him and I have talked about doing business together before. And
Yep.
that's the reason why I want to do business in Japan, and why I'm kind of interested in the, you said it was a GK.
Yep.
Why I'm interested in that, because I considered trying to do this like long term, I guess.
Now, here's some big news for anyone interested in Akiya, the abandoned vacant homes that are abundant all around Japan for very attractive purchase prices. Akiya Mart, our latest sponsor, is a recently founded online search and discovery tool for Japanese real estate. Its user interface will be very familiar to users of Zillow or Redfin. The platform essentially scouts the internet for property listings, translates them into English, and displays prices in US dollars, all in one place and with a dynamic map interface that makes browsing, finding, and shortlisting your favorite properties a piece of cake. Which any of you have been struggling with the dozens, if not hundreds, of Japanese property websites that are available online and their very clunky interface will probably find a real blessing. They've got already over 500,000 listings on the platform, and the database is expanding daily, ranging from abandoned rural homes to luxury urban properties. Akiya Mart makes it easy to find your dream home in Japan, regardless of your budget. Now, while the platform is essentially free for use, here's an exclusive offer for listeners of the podcast. You can use the promo code NTI to receive $5 off Akiya Mart Pro. The subscription will unlock a bunch of very attractive features for you, including unrestricted access to the entire nationwide property database and a whole range of filters, which will help power charge your search for that elusive perfect home and make it even easier. So hop over to akiya-mart.com. That's AKIYA-MART, akiya-mart.com, and kick off your search today. Okay, so let's take into conservative estimate. Let's say that you've invested 600,000 US and you're getting something like 4% before tax.
So that's 24,000 US. 4,000 of 24,000 is going to be like what? Divided by 24,000. Yeah, that's like 16% of your income just to keep the company alive, kind of thing. It might be a bit cheaper if he sets up the company himself. But actually, if he sets up the company himself, then he could maybe apply for a normal loan sorry, if he's going into business with you, then he could maybe apply for a normal individual, or if he has an existing company, an investment loan. And
So,
then
the contingency with those loan companies, it had you have to have a Japanese national as part of the company structure.
as a director of the company, yes.
Okay, for both of them.
Representative director. Yeah. I'm trying to figure out now if that means that they actually have to be a shareholder, which means they'll have to share in the financial obligations as well, or
Right.
they can just be a
Yeah.
salaried employee or not. So once we have that figured out, I'll let you know. So okay, so
Yeah.
that's one option. If he wants to be a part of it, it'll definitely make it cheaper because you wouldn't have to hire somebody like us, which is about 20,000 yen per month to be in that role. I know accountants and lawyers provide that service too, but I think they charge something like 50,000 yen a month from memory.
Yeah, I'm sure it's not cheap.
Yeah. So that's one option. The other option, if you want to go condo units, is the Singapore lender. I can put you in touch. I'll send you the brochure. It's got contact details on the bottom there. And that's going to be an option as well. So let's continue the conversation, assuming that you're not getting a loan. So I'm going to say your cash outlay would be somewhere between 50 to 150. Well, when do you think you'll know if you're selling that lake property or not?
So I just found out today, my broker, the one that manages the other property that I have, he's also my real estate broker. So he texted me today saying that he might have found a cash buyer for it, but he needs to go talk to him. So that's like the soonest that I know is just that.
Okay.
So
But you're saying it's relatively attractive property, so.
it's ready to go. So whoever buys it, they could easily be a turnkey Airbnb. That's the thing.
Okay. Okay. So let's assume 125,000, and let's talk as if you're not taking a loan. Obviously, you'll have more options if
Okay.
you do, but let's assume you're not borrowing here. Then that opens up most of the market for you. We can get some older and smaller, but even some Tokyo units at that price. They wouldn't be super central, but they'd probably be in relatively good locations. And then the question becomes, I'm assuming you don't want to have another short-term stay property. We're talking long-term leases, right?
So I wouldn't mind, but from what I've heard again on your, I listen to your show a lot, man. Like, so I heard you talk about how something for Minpaku's for short-term rentals that it had to be on certain weekends or it can't be on certain days or something like that or next to schools.
Depends on the municipality. Each of them will have their own local regulation. So the national framework just says you can minpaku up to half the year, but you and then the other half of the year, people usually make up for it with monthly rentals, which just falls under normal rental. But you could apply for a hotel license. It's not that big of a deal, and then you would be able to rent it out minpaku throughout the year. But what all of that means is that number one, we'll have to buy more central properties, a little bit newer, preferably family sized. If it's within a condo, if it's within a kind of owner union condo situation, then you can only do monthly. You're not going to be able to do minpaku at all. So everything has to be rented out with a lease in place, even if it's a short-term lease. So it has to be for a period of 1 month or more. And with a rental lease in place. And the lease can just be a single page kind of lease, but it has to be a normal rental, not a short-term stay with check-ins and check-outs and so forth.
Okay, so the condo wouldn't be eligible for the hotel license, right?
Not for a minpaku or hotel license, no, because the owner union would never allow it. And unless they specifically write in the owner rule book that they allow it, which 99% of them would never do, then you're not going to be able to. But monthly rentals are still an option if at least there's a monthly rentals capable company in the area that can service it, which again is a lot easier in the more central and bigger city the property's in.
So that's an option with condo units. I mean, the owner unions still don't like it, but the monthly rental companies know how to work around them. Kind of, right. They hassle them instead of the tenants, and they're fine with that. So that's an option. For actual minpaku or hotel license, you will need to own the entire structure.
Yeah,
that can so be
like an actual hotel, right?
Yeah, they call it a hotel, but the requirements are not that strict. It requires a bit more fire and safety regulation, something that looks like a reception area, but can be like a fully automated check-in, check-out machine kind of thing. So it's nothing insurmountable, but then we have to plan in advance, research the local municipality and see what their regulations are, and research local license management companies in the area, because they have to be minpaku or hotel license for management. And then we're looking at different kinds of properties as well. So you could potentially even buy, if you do end up getting a loan, you could potentially even buy a small, oh, sorry, but another thing I totally forgot. Another thing is the lenders will, as a term of the loan, you're only allowed to lease the properties out long-term, mm-hmm. no minpaku or monthly or anything of that sort.
Okay, that's a really important detail.
Yeah, they used to force you to work with their property managers for the lifetime of the loan, just to make sure you're not doing that. But right. these days, I think they've dropped that requirement. But if somehow they do find out that you're leasing out short term, they could just, you know, recall the loan or force you to switch to another loan. And that's something that you probably want to avoid.
Yeah, I don't want to do anything that's like looked unfavorably. I'd yeah. rather do everything the right way.
So bearing that in mind, let's assume you're not going to be able to get a loan if you want to go the minpaku hotel license route, which leaves you not with a small building, which you could have gotten if you had a loan, but maybe at best a older family home kind of thing that you could convert into short-term stay.
Okay.
Another thing to consider is, though, with short-term stays can be very seasonal, can fluctuate a lot with the economy and whether, you know, if we have something like borders closure again, that everything goes to zero. So, and again, as you're probably aware, the mental bandwidth, like the amount of decision-making and tweaking and, you know, looking at the rates and vacancy rates and occupancy rates and how much you're charging and how much the competition is charging. The property managers who do that will do all of that for you, but they'll constantly give you suggestions that you need to approve or disapprove, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking maybe for your first foray overseas, just go with long-term rentals. And then if and when a tenant moves out and you're in the mood, you can try to convert that maybe.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was leaning towards, was the long-term route, because I feel like it's more of a, I guess, less moving parts, right? Like
you less moving parts and more stable, reliable income as opposed to something that could fluctuate a lot. Yes. I mean, potentially it could double your yield though, but maybe leave that for the second property kind of thing.
So you said the lenders don't let you do long-term leases, right?
The lenders will only allow long-term leases.
Okay. They only allow long-term leases. Okay. Yeah.
And again, they might not find out, but let's not go there.
Yeah, let's not. Okay. So what would I be able to get if I put 150K of my cash?
Let's say 125 US. Oh, yeah. At the moment, that is 18 and a bit million yen. That will get you some quite nice condo units or family homes if they're a bit more suburban. Mm-hmm. And then with long-term leases, if you're looking at Tokyo and central Osaka, I'm guessing the best you'd get would be about 4% for a family size property. So they yield less, but they do. Family tenants do tend to stay in place a longer time and take better care of the property as well. But they are, just Japan population being the way it is, that a family takes a longer time to source. So when a property becomes vacant, you'll probably have slightly longer vacancies. But then when you do find a tenant, they'll stay in place a long time. But the yield is lower, and you need to consider that in between tenants, you obviously need to spruce up the property a bit. That the larger the property, the more that's going to cost every time, right?
Okay. And your company manages properties too, right?
Via property managers. We work with third parties anywhere in the country. So we will be the one managing the managers kind of thing on your behalf. If you're going to be buying in central Tokyo, central Osaka, I could potentially put you with a management company that can service you in English. But just bear in mind, a large part of our work consists of replacing property managers when they're not doing such a good job. So whether you'll always be able to work with someone directly or you might have to bring us in, I don't know yet.
Okay. And I know this might be kind of an up in the air question, but as far as like, say I buy a property, right? Like you said, right, with the 125, about how much do I expect to spend annually to, I guess, upkeep the property? Because I'm not very familiar with Japanese homes or architecture or anything like that.
Yeah, so if you're not going the minpaku or hotel route, I would probably stick to condo units because then you only need to care about the interior, right?
That's a really good point.
Yeah, and then, I mean, it's not that you're not paying for the structural maintenance, but you're paying a fixed fee every month that you've already factored into your yield, and then the building management company via the owner union takes care of anything structural. So you just need to worry about the interior. But those, again, would only be able to convert them into monthly rentals in the future, not minpaku, nothing like a short-term stay, right?
Okay.
And then interior, so with studios or one-bedroom apartments, which is what most of our clients own, we say normally about 60,000 yen per year of tenancy, somewhere between 60 to 80,000 yen per year of tenancy. So if you had the tenant move out after, a couple of years, it's going to be worst case, hopefully just $1,000-1,500. But if they've moved out after a long period, and especially if they're, an old man who kept the windows constantly closed and smoked in the room, which a lot of them do, then obviously that's going to be 20,000-30,000 worst case, right?
Yeah, I could just see it now.
But we could get lucky. I mean, ideally, the singles and the couples tend to stay in place for an average of 4 to 5 years.
That was my next question.
Yeah. And then families, maybe more like 8 to 10 years. But these are, again, these are all statistics, right? If you're owning a single property, it's going to be hugely skewed. So you could have a tenant move out a month after you purchase, or you could have somebody in place for 20 years after you purchase. And
yeah.
Condition the property is also, if you're buying a tenanted property, there's no inspections, not even during owner change, not even during lease renewal. You can never enter a property unless by the tenant's request.
Okay.
So the best we can do is assume what the condition of the property might be depending on the length of the tenancy and any maintenance requests that the tenants filed in the past.
Okay. I mean, I would assume the tenants are vetted too, right? Like as far as like background checks or credit checks or something like that.
And they're vetted at the time they signed the lease. But if a period has passed since they signed the lease, then we don't know what their current situation is.
Yeah. Obviously.
Okay. But we do know that, whether they've paid on time or have had any issues. Japanese tenants are a lot better than what you'd find in many other countries, definitely compared to the States. So normally they wouldn't be a huge issue, but the condition of the interior, again, is something that we can only assume when we purchase, which is another reason that a lot of our clients prefer the single or double bedrooms, single or studios, because, renovating one or two rooms is a lot cheaper than renovating a family-sized home, right?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I like the condo route. How far, as far as like when you buy a property, is the value, I guess, I'm trying to think how to ask this question. So like in the US, right, there's a lot of homes here that are 100 years old, 120 years old that are renovated and they sell for $500,000 to millions of dollars sometimes.
Yeah.
I've heard that it's a little bit different in Japan, as far as like the older the house, it seems more of like a burden. Is that true, or am I way off?
No, it's very, very true for single family homes, for houses, because those are really not built to last in Japan. So from a tax perspective, they completely depreciate in, I think, 23 years or so. And then, I mean, land can still gain in value, but the structure itself is considered worthless. They can still, obviously, a lot of them, you know, survive to 40, 50, 60 years, but they do rack up the maintenance costs at that age. So they're going to be selling for a lot cheaper. With condo units, not as much, but with condo units, especially if you're buying studio or one bedrooms, they're going to be strictly investment properties in the sense that the people who buy them would never want to live in them, and the tenants would never be able to afford to buy them, kind of thing. So those are really only evaluated based on the rental income, the rental yield that they command, right? So if rents have gone down in the last 20 years, and you know, somebody buying the property knows that they're not going to be making nearly as much when a tenant moves out. So let's say a tenant's been in there for 20 odd years, they're still paying, you know, pre or shortly after bubble prices. And Japanese tenants don't tend to negotiate rent when they renew leases, because that's, you know, from their perspective, that's like conflict. So, but somebody buying the property does know that as soon as that tenant moves out, they maybe get half the rent, right? So the price of the property would depend on what they think that they can get from it. And as a building reaches, they're mostly concrete, the condos. So as a building reaches, let's say gets close to 40 years of age, building fees tend to rise a lot more rapidly, because it requires a lot more maintenance. And that obviously affects the yield as well. So we normally recommend to customers, if you're buying a condo, make it 30 years and younger at time of purchase. You have at least 5, 6, 7 years before you need to start considering reselling it.
That was my next question.
Yeah. And then if you're buying a single family home, which, you know, again, if you're not going Minpaku Hotel, I probably would advise against it. But if you are buying a single family home, maybe make it 20 years and younger on purchase, just to give you a good 10 years before maintenance costs start racking up again.
Yeah, I think from an investment standpoint, for a first time, I'm definitely leaning more towards the condo. I guess, where do you recommend in Tokyo would be a good place to look as far as like different prefectures, like Shinjuku or Shibuya or Aoyama or
So are you laser focused on Tokyo? Because yields there are a lot lower than the rest of the country.
Yeah, I would like to invest in Tokyo first.
Okay. Definitely not Shinjuku, Shibuya. There, if you get 2-3% is the best you'd probably get before tax. It'll be the, I'd say anywhere that's, let's say, within 30, 40 minutes train ride to central Tokyo. So, to Shibuya, to Shinjuku, or to, let's say, Ueno, or, you know, to the palace or whatever. Central, let's call it around the Yamanote line, the 23 wards that are around the Yamanote line. Within 30 minutes to any location there is probably feasible. But we'll evaluate them case by case. If something comes up that's a bit further but looks like it's, you know, on a good transportation line, that might be feasible as well.
Okay. But with the cash that I bring to the table, it's pretty realistic to be able to get a condo right in any of the 23.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And not within the 23 wards. You could buy within the 23 wards as well, but it'll be older and smaller and far lower on the yield. So I'd probably recommend anything that's within 10 minute walk to a station that is within 30 minutes train ride to the main central area, to the Yamanote line.
And I ask why Shibuya and Shinjuku have such low yields. Is it because of regulation?
They're super popular, super expensive.
Wow. Oh, yeah. Well, I guess that makes sense. Yeah.
I mean, the price, the way it works is the rental price obviously rises as the property is younger and more attractive and more central, but the property price rises a lot more sharply. And that gap between the two graphs is where you kind of lose your yield.
Oh, so the price rises farther than the rent.
A lot faster, yeah. And don't forget that rents haven't gone up in Japan at all. We've maybe had a few central locations where we could raise them by about $20 a month between tenants, but that's about it. So rents are usually stagnant or go down, at least until some major economical miracle happens. So the property prices are going up because of speculators and international investors and stuff like that. But as long as salaries remain the same, nobody can raise the rent. People just can't afford it. So you're looking at a situation where your yield is definitely, again, barring some economical miracle, you're looking at a case where yields will definitely decrease over time. So if you're buying into something that's 3-4% and goes down to 2-3% after 10 years or what, it's probably not worth exploring overseas for that little, right?
What's the interest rate there right now?
What's the?
The interest rate, I guess, for mortgages over there?
For owner-occupied homes, which only Japanese permanent residents or somebody who at least looks like they're close to a permanent residence, owner-occupied homes, the interest rates is just under 1%.
Wow.
Investment loans are kind of 2.5, 2 to 3, depending on the loan and depending on the lender and depending on the borrower's profile.
Are those variable or fixed rates?
It's up to you. You can lock in both, but it's not a huge consideration. Rates haven't been really changing much in Japan in the last 20 or what years. And if you want to kind of, you know, be safe on both sides, you can specify half of it fixed rate, half of it variable rate kind of thing. Fixed would be, I think, 0.5% higher from memory, but I'm not a big expert on loans. I can put you in touch with Emil, who's on our podcast. He knows a lot more than me. Because just because vast majority of our customers are cash buyers, so we haven't really delved into it except for our own loans.
Yeah. I wish I could bring more cash to the table, just because like it gets me excited, like the opportunities that you're telling me they're in Japan as a whole. But
yeah,
you're saying Tokyo's yields are a lot lower, right, than like what as compared to like Kyoto or Osaka? Or
yeah, so let's say not central Osaka, but suburban Osaka, Kobe, Fukuoka, Kyoto is hard to find good deals. But when we do find them, Kyoto as well would probably go as high as about 6% before tax. Whereas, 6%. Whereas Tokyo and central Osaka, if we get 4, 4.5, we're very happy.
Are most of your clients outside of Tokyo?
Vast majority of them, yeah. We've managed to source a few good deals in suburban Tokyo for a few customers, but most of them just are not happy with those yields. But then if you want to stay close to Tokyo, Yokohama is a good place, Saitama City a good place. That's just like 30 minutes from Tokyo. Chiba City is not bad. Also gives you proximity to the airport. And those would, again, possibly go up to 5.5, 6-ish.
Yeah, so it'd be a middle ground between, I see, between
Tokyo. If you want to stay close to Tokyo, then those are the best options, I'd say. And there's also bedroom communities and, you know, prefectural capitals that are, say, within an hour from central Tokyo. They could get good deals as well, but then you're kind of losing out on the growth potential, I'd say.
I'm just thinking about everything that you've told me. I think the best route would be to go the single, or excuse me, to go the condo route. I was thinking about doing the GK, but I'm not too sure yet because I don't know if my friend would buy into that. I think it would have to be.
Well, the Singapore lender wouldn't require you to set up a company. The interest is higher. It's about 3.5% from memory, but they let you invest in long-term lease condos.
Yeah, out here in the United States, like the Wild West, it's crazy here. It's like in 2021, the rates were locked in at around like 3%. Now they're about 8%. So it's like almost $1,000 US dollar difference per month.
Yeah.
In the monthly payments, which is insane. But I like Japan a lot. I went there and like I said, I have my friend there. Yep. He owns about 50 gyms there. He's told me too that it's not a bad idea to start looking over there. So, I mean, I'm all for this. What's your timeline? Do I need to let you know, or like how does the process work?
I'll send you our explanation of services document, which explains how we work. There's two options basically. Definitely, if you're buying in Tokyo, I can put you directly in touch with a foreigner-friendly, really nice real estate agent that can help you conduct the purchase directly, and then. I mean, they're nice, but agents are still agents. They're transactional oriented. They're not going to necessarily point out what's the pros and cons of each property. They're just, here are the properties, you choose and I'll take care of it for you. So what most of our customers do in that case, if they are working with directly with an agent, they bring us on as consultants. And that's going to be a few $100 as opposed to a few $1,000, which we charge if we're doing everything on your behalf and we work with normal Japanese realtors, kind of the traditional ones, right? But if you do want to go that route, then we can handle everything for you at a fixed price, which is going to be based on a percentage of the property, between 3 to 5%, depending on what you're buying.
Yeah, absolutely. I would love to retain y'all just because I've listened to your podcast so much. You drop a bunch of knowledge. I'm going to be honest. I'm coming off of being kind
blushing
of
sick. Now. Thank you.
I'm being honest. I'm coming off of being kind of sick. So like my brain's not all there right now. But like I know I'm going to start getting ideas and questions popping into my head. So like to have you on my team, to pay your fee, like I'm more than happy to do that. To have that relationship established. Like
we're happy to bring you on. Yeah. Either structure works for us.
Yeah, absolutely. This has been an awesome conversation. I'm super excited now.
Awesome.
So I'm off for doing this. Like I know you might get a lot of people like reaching out to you and like kind of like on the fence. But like when I decide I'm going to do something, I'm going to do it. So like
I know you sound like that. I'm not getting the feeling you're a tire kicker.
Yeah. So like it's more so of like how do I get to that point now, which I already know. I just need to do it.
Yeah. So I'll reply to your last email with our explanation of services document. That'll lay out exactly what's involved in engaging us and how we work and all of that. So just have a quick read through that. And then whenever you're ready, just send me a name and address to put on the invoice and we'll get started.
Yeah, absolutely.
Awesome.
Thank you so much.
Are you joining our seminar on Sunday? What time zone are you in?
I'm in Central Standard Time. I didn't know there was a seminar on Sunday.
Yeah, so if you have a look at my signature at the bottom of the email, you can buy a live streaming ticket, which will let you join the Q&A, but I'm not sure what the time difference is. It might be a bit of an all-nighter for you. the recordings, the presentations and stuff will be available and uploaded to the podcast, but it's a really good chance to just ask questions, get Q&A live. We'll have Tracy, who's a Minpaku and hotel expert, Emil, who's a mortgage expert, and Anton, who's an Akia and renovation expert and also does Airbnb. So actually probably a good chance to ask to pick their brains a bit too if you can stay up there.
Yeah, that sounds like a great opportunity. I might take y'all up on that.
Awesome. So yeah, you'll see that in my signature of the email, and I'll reply to your email just now with the explanation of services document and we'll take it from there.
Yeah, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Speak to you soon.
Talk soon.
Bye.
Thank you.
There you have it. Nice, long, comprehensive chat with a savvy young investor. I really enjoyed this one. Hope you did too. And now for our second call. This one is audio only, also with another US-based investor. And she's just about to start investing in Japan for the first time as well. And we talk in more detail about tenants this time around. So long-term tenants versus short-term guests, family tenants versus singles and couples, tenancy laws, landlord obligations, the types of properties that are more attractive to different types of tenants, which are easier to populate, how do rental leases work in Japan, how do yields differ between all of these different strategies. And we then segue into a conversation about yields again, as well as the purchase process itself, how to submit offers, conduct due diligence, contract signing, settlement, all of that. And then finally, we talk vacancies, various locations and times of the year, price comps and how listing prices are determined for investment properties, purchase and running costs again, and once more, potential capital growth, how to engage our services, the usual stuff. Again, super thorough conversation on multiple topics. Enjoy the chat, and I'll see you again one last time on the other side.
We interrupt this broadcast to tell you about Tokyo Family Stays. They're a short-term rentals company in Tokyo, and they offer a home away from home experience, which is just perfect for remote working, quarantining, if that's still a thing, or if you just need somewhere quiet to get away from the world. They offer a variety of options for families, corporate relocations, or even if you're simply transitioning between homes in Tokyo. The properties are super comfortable, tastefully furnished, fully equipped with all amenities, and they accommodate up to 10 people. So really the only thing you'll need to bring with you is your toothbrush and maybe a change of clothes. They come with fast unlimited wireless internet, dedicated workspaces and fully equipped kitchens, and they're just a delight to stay in, fantastic alternative to Japanese business hotels, which if you've ever stayed in one, you probably know they're tiny, they're noisy, fine for a night or two if you're on your own, but longer term or with a family, you'll probably feel you're in a jail cell very quickly in a Japanese business hotel. So if you want to give yourself a sense of space and freedom by renting a real home with comfortable Western beds, including all the necessities like baby bedding, children's toys, high chairs, etc., you definitely want to reach out to Tokyo Family Stays. They've been at it for over a decade. They're a fully licensed minpaku or short-term stay operator. And as a special bonus for our viewers and listeners, they're also throwing in a breakfast basket upon arrival for anyone who books and mentions the Japan Real Estate Podcast or NTI. And not only for guests, if you're a property owner, you've got an investment property that you want to tweak for higher profit, or a holiday home that you want to rent out when you're not using it via short-term stays, drop them a line today. See how they can help you maximize your property's income. And again, as a special bonus to our viewers and listeners, they're also offering a free audit of your existing short-term stay listings without any obligation whatsoever. So feel free to reach out to them at tokyofamilystays.com. Well worth a visit. And again, if you're in the market for a family home in or around the Tokyo metropolitan area, Emil's your man. Don't be shy to reach out to him as well at sales@realestate.jp. And now back to the podcast. Yeah, so I've browsed through your email. Just let me bring it up again. My first question would be, you mentioned that you're looking for an investment property. Does that mean that you're not going to be using it on your own?
So probably in the future, I'm going to use it on my own. So for now, it's for investment property.
Right. In that case, can I ask why short-term stay and not just a long-term tenant?
So, no, not short-term. So I'm looking for long-term. And then maybe in the future, if possible, can turn it to short-term.
Ah, gotcha.
So, that's just the plan. But if it's like too much work for me or like for another side, I'm okay with the long term. It seems like long term is like less work because I do have long term tenants as well.
Yeah, definitely less work.
Less work than short term. But I know short term it's. It creates more profits. That's what I heard. I never done short term before.
It can be the case, but it would need to be really well managed, constantly keeping an eye on occupancy, vacancy rates, fine tuning it to a particular guest profile so that you can stand out from the competition for those types of guests and so forth. So okay. I wouldn't say it's a full time job, but it's definitely a lot more bandwidth consumption involved.
Yeah, true. Mm. That is true. But that's just like long-term in the future, if that's possible. But for now, I am way too busy to do that.
Yep.
So probably now, a couple of years.
Well, the other advantage of short-term rentals is you've mentioned that you might want to use the property yourself in the future. If you've got a long-term tenant in there, essentially the way tenancy laws work in Japan is that a long-term lease is supposedly automatically renewed at the end of every two-year period. And if
it's automatically?
Yes. You can't just kick a tenant out, or you can't even just raise the rent on them, right? They've got more rights than you do. I mean, they're Japanese tenants, so they're usually not going to create a problem, but what you'd normally need to do if you want them to leave is notify them and offer them compensation of about a year's worth of rent, because that's what it costs them to then relocate to a new place.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know that. That's
so lease signing fees and deposits and agency fees in Japan tend to be between 4 to 6 months for new tenants. And then they've got the entire moving expenses. They need to remove everything from the property. And they've obviously lost the initial deposits that they've placed when they moved in. So we normally would offer them a year, and then they tend to move out without a problem.
So you're saying like give notice for them like a year before?
The normal lease terms usually indicate 6 months before renewal is when both parties need to inform each other if they don't want to renew. But with tenants, they can just move out at a month or two's notice usually.
And the most you'll be able to get from them is a month or two in additional fees. But from the landlord perspective, again, Japanese tenants would normally not take you to court or insist unless you happen to land on a old bored man or a foreigner. Foreigners are a lot more aware of their rights in that respect. So normally they would move out, but to avoid a situation where they try to insist or you know, in severe cases, take you to court, which never happened to us but could potentially happen, and then we would offer them a 1 month 1 year compensation.
That's like 1 year of rent compensation.
Correct. Okay. Which again is fair because that's what it costs them to relocate.
Oh,
wow.
That's really different.
Yeah. The reason these laws were made stricter in the past is because landlords were taking advantage of Japanese tenants. I mean, your average vanilla type Japanese is very docile. They just nod their head and go when you tell them to. And landlords were just kicking them out and then charging the whole move-in fees again for the new tenant and then recycling that. So the laws have been tightened to disallow them from doing that.
Okay. All right. That's good to know. What else? Also, I saw a lot of studio size compared to 2 or 3 bedrooms. So, do Japanese prefer small house? Like, is it more desirable?
It just caters to a larger part of the population, so your tenant base becomes bigger and easier to repopulate a property when it becomes vacant, because just the way birth rates are in Japan, a lot of people are staying single, a lot of people are elderly folks who never had kids or are just not in contact with their kids, so it's always easy to find a tenant for these smaller properties. But they're obviously lower quality tenants as well, so there is something to be said for a larger property that would host a family. Families tend to stay in place longer, so the vacancy would be a bit longer until you find one, but then when they stay in place, it'll be for, let's say, on average 8-10 years as opposed to 4-5 years for singles. Mm-hmm. And also families tend to take better care of the house than a single or kind of destitute elderly gentleman.
Oh, so is that a property have, like, for example, in US, we do have a class A, class B, class C. Is that it depends on the location itself? So I can get, like, you know, more quality tenant.
Yeah, it's not as strictly regimented in categories, but that's the case here as well, yes. But obviously you're going to get lower yields as well. In Japan, space is a really premium kind of commodity. So the bigger the property is, it's going to cost much more, but rent will not rise as sharply as the price. So the yield, in that gap, the yield tends to drop. So if you're looking at these studio or one bedroom apartments, we can potentially, depending on the city, but we can potentially get up to say 6-6.5 yield before tax percent. With family size properties, except some unique cases, it's normally going to be more like 4 or 5 at best.
Okay, so it seems like it's better studio and one bedroom. Okay.
And also there's a sweet spot there with the age. If you're looking at condo units, stuff built between 20 to 30 years ago tends to generate better yield than anything younger, obviously. Uh-huh. And also when the building gets older, it's getting harder and harder to find tenants, because even the ones who, you know, are not very high income earners, if they have other options which are, you know, similar rent, they obviously go for something cheaper, for something newer. And also building fees tend to rise more rapidly as the building approaches about 40 years of age, and developers start sniffing around trying to buy it cheaply off the owner union by convincing them that they should sell soon, and that's not always at the best price. So the sweet spot is usually 20 to 30 years of age upon purchase, and studio or one bedroom unit, maybe 2 bedroom if it's a particularly attractive deal. But having said all of that, for short-term rentals, it's much better to have family-sized properties, because there's a lot of these studio apartments available for rent on Airbnb and so forth. Mm-hmm. So if you do happen to have a bigger property, then that would most likely generate better returns on the short-term front if you ever do that.
Okay, but for long-term, it's better studio than one bedroom.
It depends on the investor. Some people are happy with higher quality tenants and higher quality properties, you know, and are willing to live with the lower yields? Because those yields, I mean, those yields that I've just quoted you are on paper when you purchase the property, but newer properties, bigger properties tend to hold their rental values better than these smaller ones. There's, again, because there's a lot of competition. So whenever there's a new development built in the neighborhood, it's kind of a race to the bottom, begins with all of the people owning older units. Mm-hmm. So that 5, 6, 6.5 yield might not hold as well as it as a newer, nicer property as well. So they would be lower on yield from purchase, but they would hold that yield for a longer number of years normally.
Okay, so it's probably called sports side. Okay.
Yeah.
Can you tell me like the process buying a house in Japan? Because like how long, or like for example, like
sure.
Offering, and then what else? Like, do they have appraisal, inspection, you know, request repairs, kind of stuff?
Okay, so I'll just add one last point to that previous discussion, is that with I lost it now. I wanted to mention one more thing about the yield and I completely forgot. All right, it'll come back to me. So the purchase process here is essentially similar to what you know overseas with a few differences. One of the main differences is that when you submit an offer, it's not legally binding and you don't need to pay anything when you submit the offer. But the way Japan works is everything is very, there's norms and manners involved in every process, including purchase. So it's normally assumed that if you submitted an offer, the offer can be pending due diligence, and we'll get into that in a minute. But if you submitted an offer without any particular conditions on it, then it's kind of assumed that you're going to go ahead with the purchase if the offer is accepted. So we normally ask our customers not to submit multiple offers and then just go with the one they like the best. Just take them one at a time. And if we're pulling back an offer, we need to explain very clearly why we're doing that. Otherwise, that agent will not work with us, and in most cases with any foreigners again. And once you submit an offer and the offer has been accepted or renegotiated and then accepted, then it takes about a month from then to signing the contract, at which point you'll be paying a 10% deposit. And then another month, just because you're overseas and a couple of documents need to be executed and posted here. So another month to settlement normally, which is when you'll be paying the rest of the money.
Okay. So the total, like, about 2 months, the closing?
From the moment an offer is accepted. Yeah, it could take a bit longer or a lot longer than that until you find the one that you actually want to go ahead with. And there could be quite a few offers that the way due diligence works is that a lot of the time the information is not going to be made available before an offer is accepted, because the agent and the seller, in case of condo units, the agents and the sellers need to contact the building management company and pay a fee of about $50 to get the building's renovation history and reserve funds total and all of the things that we want to look at. Mm-hmm. So what we normally do is we submit an offer and we say this offer is pending tenant information, building information, and so forth. And that's when we start getting all of that information. So at that point, there could definitely be a lot of properties that we'll be backing out of because we're not satisfied with that information. Right?
Okay. So during the offer, is there any, like, it's going to be like inspection, to see like, is there anything to be repaired, something like major, or like is Japan do that, or like I know like in US it's really big thing about inspection.
So in the case of tenanted properties, again, tenancy laws are very strict here. No one is allowed to enter a property, even when it's being sold, even when a contract, when a lease is renewed. Nobody enters a property unless it's by the tenant's request. So the only information about the interior of the... Oh, that reminds me what I wanted to say too. So the only information about the interior of the property is going to be based on what the property manager currently knows, which is going to be based on any maintenance request the tenant has submitted. But Japanese tenants, as a rule, try to avoid any kind of communication or negotiation or what they label as conflict. So a lot of the time, especially if you've got elderly folks living there, a lot of the time there might be stuff that's broken down over the years and they just haven't mm-hmm. reported or done anything about.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it is a bit of a sight unseen. And that brings me back to the earlier point that I forgot, is that if you're buying a studio or a two-bedroom, obviously any renovations and repairs, especially between tenants, are going to be much cheaper than a full-sized family home, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sure. Okay. So cost it a kind of like turnkey, right? Am I right?
If it's tenanted, you could. If it's tenanted, you could potentially buy vacant, and then the property would have been recently renovated. But then you're buying into a few months of vacancy and expenses, as opposed to a turnkey income from day one.
Okay. Speaking of that, so let's say I buy something like vacant, and you mentioned like 2-3 months vacancy. It could be like that long to get a tenant.
If it's in a good location, if it's in a bad location or a bad time of the year, it can be even longer than that. But we'll try to from the get-go steer you towards locations and properties that would fall into that shorter range that are more desirable. But for example, let's say you bought in Sapporo or somewhere that's a bit more snowy and cold long winters. If you happen to lose a tenant during the winter, people don't like to move around when it snows, so they'll wait until spring to start moving back in.
Yeah, same thing like over here, holidays is longer. Yeah.
Yeah, and also, for example, if it's a property that's close to university campus, a lot of your potential tenants are going to be students or faculty, and they tend to, the hot season for those is usually around February, March, because the school year starts in April here. So other times of the year, could take longer to populate. Also, if you're depending on supply and demand in the area, the property manager might advise to reduce the rent to compete with other comparable properties. If you'll want to not do that and keep the rent as it was, then obviously it will take longer because we'll have to wait for all of the other offers to be occupied first.
One more thing, I don't know if it's common or not, but I don't see any comps. For example, over here we do have, it's called ARRMS. So,
ARROMS. What does that mean? Sorry?
Oh, it's an MLS. Like, we can see,
Historical sale prices and that? You mean like Zillow and stuff?
Correct, yes.
Not much of that here. The real estate agents that we work with on each particular sale do have access to a realtor-only historical database, but not all properties appear on there. The only properties that appear in the RAINS, which is the name of that database, are properties that the listing agents are willing to share with other agents. But when they do that, they have to share their commission as well. So a lot of agents will not put their properties in that national database because they want to be the exclusive agent representing both sides so they can charge both. What we can do is we can research historical listing. A lot of the MLS websites, we call them MLS, but they're not similar to what you've got there. But a lot of the bigger websites that have a lot of properties on them also have archive sections. So if there have been recent sales in that building, we could potentially get some data about that.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to compare the prices.
Yeah, but with investment properties, that's not really a good indication because investment properties are not susceptible to the same trends that you see with owner home properties. So with owner occupied properties, if an area is more desirable and people really want to live there, then that property will rise in price. But with investment properties, and those studio and two bedrooms are strictly investment properties, the people who buy them will never want to live in them, and vice versa, the tenants who live in them will never be able to afford buying them. So those properties are priced solely on the rental income that they command. So if the previous sale on that same property or a comparable one was higher, it probably means that rents have gone down in that area, and therefore the purchase price is, I mean, investors are just not going to pay as much if they're not making as much.
Okay. I want to ask you about the tax. So about the tax rental income, do I have to pay in Japan or in the US?
You firstly pay in Japan if you're going to be up for it, because the minimum threshold here is about 485,000 yen annually net pre-tax. So once you factor in all of your purchase costs and management costs, if you're earning less than 485,000 yen a year, which is about, I think, 4,000 US at the moment, then you're tax-free. In which point you're only going to be taxed on as part of your normal income tax in the US, because you do have to report income from overseas. If you have paid any tax in Japan, then you bring your tax statement to your accountant, and then Japan and the US have a tax treaty in place, so you're not going to be charged twice, you're just going to be charged for the difference in the US.
Okay, that makes sense. All right, I want to ask you about the property management questions. It seems like your company offer that services.
Via third parties. So everything we do, we're a single point of contact in English, and then we enlist realtors and property managers. We liaise with the building management company, the owner union, but everything is done via outsourcing to third parties.
Oh, okay. Okay. So you're not doing, okay. I see. So for example, like the property I'm going to get is vacant. And then how does this work? You guys like do screening possible tenants?
Yes, so there's no credit checks per se like you would have in the States, but what we normally ask is, so if it's turnkey and you've inherited a tenant, then whatever the terms of the lease are, we'll find out. But when we place a new tenant ourselves, we normally insist on a rental guarantee or rent insurance. And then the tenant has to sign up with a guarantee company, and they check their employment status and credit, not really officially credit website like you can do in the States, but they definitely screen the tenant. And they, if they don't accept the tenant on as guarantors, then we also probably don't want that tenant. The only exceptions are, for example, foreign students or people who have just relocated back to Japan recently and they don't have employment history because they've been overseas previously, then we might consider to take them on, in which case we'll ask them to pay a security deposit instead.
Oh, okay. Speaking of security deposits, so not every tenant has security deposit?
We can ask them. We would normally prefer the guarantee company because the guarantee company will compensate you up to 3 months of missing rent or you know, in the case of an absconding tenant and we have to get a court case to one-sidedly terminate the lease, then they'll keep paying rent until that right is granted to us. Whereas a security deposit is just going to be a month or two at best. So we prefer to go with a guarantee company if we can. It makes for better compensation for the owner.
Oh, so it's like go to a different company again just to get security deposit.
No, security deposit is something, if we, for some reason, the guarantee company refuses to take on the tenant, then we, via the property manager, we'll just be charging them a cash security deposit instead.
Oh, okay. All right. Let's see. What else do I want to ask? So, turnover rate. Do you think, in Japan, like a lot of turnover rate? Well, I know the lease agreement is like 2 years.
It's a 2 years rolling lease. So like I explained at the start, it's expected to automatically renew every 2 years.
Unless they tell us like they don't want to renew.
Unless they leave, and they might leave mid-lease as well. There's not really any huge penalty for them, just a month or two of rent. But normally, our average with single tenants has been somewhere between 4 to 5 years. So let's call it 4.5.
Oh, okay.
And with families, something like 8 to 10 years, so call it 9.
Okay. So do you have any experience like they're breaking the lease? You know, I know like the lease like at minimum 2 years. Let's say they want to move 1 year. They decide just, I want to leave. Are there any penalty for that?
1 or 2 months of rent is most you'll get from them.
Oh, okay.
The lease normally stipulates 2 months penalty within the first year and 1 month penalty within the second year.
Now, if you've been following this podcast for a while, and in particular our JREP sessions, you're probably more than familiar with Blanca Kobayashi of Arc Reform. They're a bilingual renovation company serving clients in the Kanagawa and Kanto area, so Tokyo, Chiba, Saitama, Kawasaki, Yokohama. They can handle simple, small-scale projects as well as full house renovations, and they will work with you on the perfect design for your dream family home. But not only homes, Arc Reform also handle commercial property renovations, offices, restaurants, bars, shops, you name it, from traditional classics to the latest trends in interior design and renovations. So you want to email them for a free consultation and quote at info@arcreform.com. That's A-R-K reform, all one word, .com, and give your home or commercial space the love and care that it deserves.
All right. I think the last one I want to ask you is the fees. Like, what kind of fees that I need to wear from buying and also the management?
So the purchase cost, assuming you're going through us, the purchase costs are going to be, depending on the price of the property, somewhere between 15 to 20% normally.
Okay.
If you're going directly with the realtor, then you can take our fee off, which is about 5%, at least at the price levels that you're discussing. It gets cheaper if they're more pricey properties. And that consists of the realtor fee, which is 3% plus 60,000 yen plus tax, which works out to be somewhere between 4.5% to 5.5%. Our fee, which is 5.5%, these are all including consumption tax. So it's actually 5% plus 10%, the equivalent of GST. So 5 becomes 5.5% and so forth. Okay. Legal and registration fees, depending on the price of the property, are going to be somewhere between 3 to 6%. They vary depending on the official evaluation, which is always different to market price. And then
I was going to ask you management fee.
Yeah, hang on. We're not done with the purchase fees yet.
Okay, bye.
And then there's a purchase tax statement, which comes in somewhere between 6 to 24 months after the purchase, depending on which period of the year you've purchased in. Mm-hmm. And that is, worst case, about 2.5%, usually closer to about 1.5%, because, again, it varies depending on the official evaluation. So if you add all of those together, the purchase cost would come to, worst case, 20%, maybe closer to 16, 17, depending on the price of the property.
Okay.
And then management costs. So the property managers charge 5% plus tax normally of the gross rental income.
That's monthly?
That's monthly, yeah.
Okay. That's include, like, for example, like screening tenant, that kind of stuff, it's 5%? Or like,
that's, you know, like for over here? That's for managing the property while it's tenanted. I'll get to the placement costs in a minute.
Okay.
So 5.5%, so 5% plus tax, so 5.5% of the gross rental income per month. In some areas where there's only a handful of them available, they might charge a bit more than that. In bigger cities where there's a bunch of them available, they might charge a bit less. But the average, the industry norm is usually 5.5%. And building fees very much vary depending on the building. So when we analyze investment deals for you, we'll put in all of those fees and you'll see the bottom line. But the building fees can be anywhere from 5,000 yen a month to 20, 30,000 yen a month, depending on how fancy and how new the building is.
Okay.
But those percentage yields that I've mentioned at the start, say up to 6, 6.5%, those are including all of those fees. And then our fee for managing a property is a minimum of 3,080 yen per month, or 2,800 plus tax. And we charge, if you happen to get a property, but I don't think the budget you've specified, probably not, but if you happen to purchase a property that generates beyond 160,000 yen per month in rent, then we just charge 2.2%, which becomes then higher than the 3,000. But that's not likely going to be within your budget, a property that generates as much as that.
Okay.
And then placement fees. The property managers charge 1 month themselves, but they also share the listing with other property managers to try and speed up the tenanting. If another property manager sources a tenant, then they also need to get paid 1 month. So the normal fees are between 1 to 2 months when they place a tenant.
Okay.
And then we charge half a month, regardless of where the tenant came from. So 1.5 to 2.5 is the minimum. And again, if the property is in a location or a time of year or the rent price that you want to get is making it more challenging, then we would have to offer various bonuses. So, for example, we might offer an increased commission to any property manager who can find us a tenant. So that'll be maybe 1 month extra. Or we might offer a first month free of rent to a tenant, which also makes it 1 month extra. If it's really, really tough, we might suggest to do both of these. Or an alternative to that would be to maybe owner participates in the move-in fees for the tenant, which can also come to about a month, month and a half. So we'll take it case by case. If we see within a month or two that it's extremely challenging, then we'll start suggesting to increase the placement costs by offering one or more of these bonuses.
That's pretty much all my questions. Yeah, I don't have anything else.
That's good. I mean, you'll have a lot more once we start looking at individual properties, I promise.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So, yeah, speaking of the individual property, any suggestion, you know, city-wise or I don't know. You have more experience than me.
I'd say, so you're saying that you've got other, what we normally ask customers is what sort of other investments they got, whether in other countries or in Japan. In your case, it's not in Japan, but what does the rest of your portfolio look like? Is it relatively high yield? Is it relatively safe and stable? What does it look like?
So for me, I would say quite high yield.
Okay.
Since I manage my own, that's made no fees at all. The only fees obviously is maintenance, which is very high in the US. But I got so far pretty good tenants. They're pretty quiet. They're not like keep calling me every day or at night, you know, get something. You know. They're, let's see, it's pretty, it's not that risky. I think I would say pretty stable. And besides, I bought those property before pandemic.
Yep.
And then the rental is pretty high. It's pretty profitable.
Okay.
Yeah.
But, well, in that, I mean, it's up to you. In that case, we can continue with the safe and stable, in which case I'd probably recommend one of the top seven cities in Japan. So Tokyo, Osaka, Fukuoka, Kyoto, Nagoya, Yokohama, maybe Sapporo, if we can find good deals there, because we want to aim for higher yields in colder climate properties. Just maintenance costs and vacancies tend to cost more.
Appreciation,
yeah, so that was going to be the second point. If you want to aim for potential appreciation, which is anyone's guess in Japan, but it has been happening in bigger cities in the last 12 years, then I would stick to those cities. And then the best you'd probably generate is 5.5% less if it's in Tokyo or central Osaka. In Fukuoka, we sometimes can manage 6%. In Nagoya as well, but tenants tend to be a bit more blue-collar, so we have more absconding and kind of, you know, potentially slightly delinquent tenants in Nagoya. Otherwise, if you want to aim for just higher yields, cash flow, that sort of thing, then we can also look at prefectural capitals or bedroom communities around the bigger cities. They would potentially get up to 6-6.5%, but then I'd say capital growth potential is iffy at best.
Is that the yield after the tax or before tax?
Before tax.
That's before tax.
But again, at that budget, you're probably not going to be paying much tax in Japan. So it's just a matter of what sort of tax situation you've got in the U.S. For the rest of it.
Okay. I was wondering if you can give me a sample from, let's say, the high yield and possibly the one with appreciation. I just want to compare. You
know, yeah, for sure. So.
Yeah.
I'll ask, we can put in a couple of hours of just complimentary research before you've actually engaged us, just to give you an idea of what's out there. So if you could reply to our last correspondence asking to see some samples, then Faye, who has been answering you previously, will get that done for you over the next couple of weeks or so.
Okay, so let's say I'm interested. Like, do I need to sign a contract with you and I have to pay an advance first, or how does it work?
So to engage us, so we can put in again those couple of hours complimentary research, and I'm always happy to jump on calls and discuss particular properties and issues and stuff. But when you want us to dig in deeper and do more research and start contacting agents and sellers and so forth, at that point we will need to be engaged. So there are two documents that you'll need to have signed and witnessed, our contract of services and our limited power of attorney to enable us to work here on your behalf.
Mm-hmm.
You can take your time executing those. We'll only need to show them to anyone when we're getting closer to signing a contract. But we do need our fee estimate paid in advance. So we'll charge you based on what you think the budget is, and then post-settlement we'll credit or debit depending on the end purchase price.
Okay, that sounds fair.
Yeah.
All right. Let's start from there.
Starts good. That sounds good. So, again, just reply to our last correspondence with what exactly you want us to search for, and we'll get Faye on that for you.
Okay, so you just want to email you back? Like, what do I want
to... Yeah, budget, minimum yield, budget. Maximum yield, and if you want to see samples from various yields or various types of cities, just put that in there as well.
Okay, all right. I'll do that. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Great speaking to you.
All right.
Bye.
Have a good day.
You
Bye.
Too. All right, nice few conversations again. Hope you enjoyed them. And once more, if you still haven't secured your tickets for the April 6th summit in Tokyo, either in person or via the live stream, hop over to nippontradings.com now and grab your tickets. They are selling fast.
Now, before we go, we're also, as always, going to tell you and also link to our other sponsor's website. That's Hiroshi Shimizu, immigration lawyer and administrative scrivener. If you're thinking about moving here on a more permanent basis, or you're already in Japan on some sort of a temporary visa, and you want to switch to a longer term or permanent one, or if you're considering setting up a local company or a branch office of a foreign company, and you've got any sort of business or visa-related inquiries, or even if you just want to find out what your options are on any of these topics, feel free to contact Hiroshi Shimizu. You can find him at japanimmigrationexperts.com. And he can help you set up a company, apply for any kind of visa, or just provide you with the best advice and extremely affordable consultation related to these topics. And he's already done that for many of our listeners. So feel free to reach out to him. Again, that's japanimmigrationexperts.com, and you'll be well on your way. And that's it from us for today, folks. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Japan Real Estate Podcast. Do share it with your networks, and please let us know what you think. So leave us a short rating or review on the iTunes Store, on Spotify, or just drop us a line in the comment section of wherever you might have found this episode. We love hearing from you. Hope to have you with us again next time, and until then, have a great day or night ahead. Yoroshiku.